Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we have the lovely Cynthia Baseman. She's the blogger mom, the Beverly Hills blogger mom, and she's also written a wonderful book called Love Mom. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you, Sherry. Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited to have you here. I think your blog is great.
Oh, thank you. It's a lot of fun to write.
Tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I grew up in Beverly Hills, and I had parents that were very solid, you know, came from very working class backgrounds and kind of taught me the value of a dollar, and nothing came, you know, instant like some people would have you think growing up in Beverly Hills. Anything I wanted, you know, back then it was music, wanting an LP or going to see like a Mel Brooks movie or something as a kid. I had to work for it. So it was good. I think it kind of kept my head on straight as I continued to grow up here.
Yeah, especially in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, you know, it's you have, you know, all kinds of people here. It's kind of an international destination, and you know, some of the kids I went to high school with were driving like Mercedes 450 SLs, and you know, it was, if you didn't kind of have a solid sense of who you were, you could get pretty mixed up.
Oh, I had the same experience. I lived in San Fernando Valley in Granada Hills, and I had friends who drove jalopies, and I had other friends who drove Mercedes. So LA is a melting pot. It's just one of those interesting areas.
It is. It really is. It's changed a lot, though. I mean, since I grew up here, it's much more crowded and many more cars on the road. And, you know, people continue to be able to make their living here. There's a lot of opportunities. So it does draw more and more people here all the time. So it's, you know, I do lament the quieter days a little bit.
I think we all do. And I miss all the wonderful places that used to be there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, when I was a little girl, Ventura Boulevard was like Restaurant Row. Now it's Automobile Sales Row. I mean, it's just, Wilshire Boulevard's unrecognizable to me.
Yeah, and I mean, for here, there's no more bookstores in Beverly Hills.
I know, and that's bad.
Yeah, and when I saw the last one go, it was just terrible, you know, for someone who just loves to read. And also the people that work there, this was Dutton's I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They had one in Brentwood, too. These guys, you could go in there and come out with a completely different selection of books just based on talking to someone who worked there because they knew so much.
Yeah. That's the world I grew up in. I mean, the one in Brentwood or Beverly Hills that they used to have like standing orders for people like Frank Sinatra, and you know, he'd order books, and they send out whatever the latest bestsellers were to him.
That was probably like Dalton's,
or Brittano's. It was
There were two right across the street from each other on Rodeo.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, like, a bookstore trying to open on Rodeo now?
I know, but then it was...
The rent there must be so incredible.
It was a wonderful world.
Yeah. That's the problem. You shop on Amazon, you don't have the incredible book clerk to talk to and find out, you know, what's happening. So.
Or the used bookstores. There was a bookstore called Dutton's that was near where I lived, and the guy who owned it, he knew everything. And one year my mom wanted to get my father was a big book reader, and my mom wanted to get my dad a special present, and I went in to ask about first editions.
Mm-hmm.
And he got it for me.
Wow. Yeah, that's a whole other ball game now. I mean, if you try to find a first edition, unless you're at one of these, like, heritage bookshop or some really, like, outrageously expensive place like that, if you go online, it's really buyer beware, because I love old books. Mm-hmm. And I have tried from time to time to get, like, I love Larry McMurtry, to try to get first editions of his books. And I had a correspondence going with some fellow who sells books, and he said, Cynthia, it can look like the real deal. It could have his real signature on it, but it could simply be a book where somebody carefully removed the page that had his signature on it and inserted it into another book, and you would never be able to tell. He said he could tell, but he said, I would never be able to tell, and I could be spending so much money. Yeah, it's scary. So I really stopped buying that stuff.
I know. The only way you can really get a deal now is to go, like, to garage sales and stuff like that. Because they don't care about that stuff, so they just want to get rid of their grandmother's books. And they're like, you go in and you can get these wonderful old books. And it's like,
you can. Yeah, I have had that happen. It's always like a, you know, it's something you never expected to see, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm going to see William compilation of plays or something. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, I want
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'll take that. I know you're a big reader, but what are your favorite books?
Oh, so many, so many. Well, I mentioned Larry McMurtry. I really think he is a star, and I've read, you know, many of his books, and his dialogue is unbelievable. It just, he never hits a false note, ever, ever, ever. So I'm insanely jealous of his talent. In fact, just, I'll go off on a tangent here for a second. I told my husband, if I ever leave you, it's going to be for Larry McMurtry. No, Larry's like 85.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I know how you feel.
Anyway,
I have questions like that myself.
Yeah. George R. R. Martin, he's another one. He's so masterful. His imagination is out of this world. And I seriously hadn't read the fantasy genre since I was a teenager. I kind of read and read and read it, and then I stopped and I moved on, and I began reading many other things. And the Game of Thrones series just grabbed me and hooked me in, like one of those things where you wake up in the morning and you're like, oh, I can't wait till it's bedtime again so I can curl up with my George R. R. Martin, you know, Game of Thrones, whatever the latest one, and they're so long. Sherry, have you read them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
they're like 1,000 pages each.
I don't know. I'm more of a Harry Potter girl.
Are you?
I love J.K. Rowling. I just love her work. I just love her books.
She's also, you know, masterful imagination, and
that's
it's amazing how many people have borrowed from her.
I know. It's kind
of
funny. I mean, but it was like there was hope because all these kids were dying for her book, and it was like everybody was reading the book. And I was like, oh, my gosh, does this mean there's a resurgence? And it just kind of stopped right after her book.
What I think was so great about Harry Potter is that, you know, I have two boys, and they're you know, a little older now. But when a couple years ago when it was, you know, time to look for books for them, it was, you know, the heroes were always heroines. The publishers decided that girls are the ones that buy books, and that's what they were producing. And Harry Potter, she got it right, because, you know, you did have Harry, and he's the protagonist, but you had very strong women characters and girl characters all throughout.
Hermione.
Yeah. And, you know, it's everything else is such slim pickings.
I know. It's sad.
It is bad, and, you know, it's a circle. You know, if the publishers say, okay, I want to buy books with heroines, well, then the writers stop, you know, developing stories. If they think they can't sell it, or their agents tell them they can't sell it, then they stop writing these kinds of stories. And, you know, it's a little disappointing for the boys, I think. It does turn them away.
Well, I think that one of the problems that is facing people that are creative today is that everything seems to be driven. It always was driven by money, but there was a lot of bad stuff by the old presses and by the old studios and things like that. But the good thing is that they weren't just money men. They were creative geniuses, the people who started all of the books publishers and the movie studios and later on the TV studios. Money was very important. That's how they survived. But they took chances. They were riverboat gamblers, theater too. Mm-hmm. They rolled the dice and they tried. Nowadays, everybody's so terrified of having a bomb.
I was just talking to a friend of mine, Gavin Pallone, who's a very prolific filmmaker, producer. And we walk on Saturdays. There's Tuesdays with Maury. I have Saturdays with Gavin. And he was saying, look at theater. Look at how all they're doing is remaking.
TV
remaking.
Shows.
Yes.
Movies.
And old movies, Dirty Dancing.
It used to be the other way around. Theater used to bring, they used to take for
from
the movies
and
TV
mm-hmm.
shows from the theater. Now theater's taking from them. Where is the playwrights? Well, I know where they are. They're being stopped from doing their stuff.
Yeah, they've got their day jobs, right, like us all. But they do a disservice.
They
you
do.
Have to take a chance with art, and sometimes it works, and a lot of times it doesn't. But I just saw Backbeat over the weekend, and I really liked it, and I learned some things about the Beatles that I didn't know before. But it's definitely an area that's been mined many, many, many times.
Beatlemania.
Exactly.
My mom saw it, and she said, what, are they bringing back Beatlemania? And I go, no, it's a new one.
Yeah, I it's exactly what went through my mind. And my husband, who, grew up, on the Beatles and knows so much about them, he just said, it was fine. It was okay. But he didn't really learn anything new. And that's a shame.
Yeah.
When you go to the theater, you've got to...
It's supposed to inspire you.
Yes.
It's supposed to ignite your imagination.
Or challenge you. Something. Mm-hmm. Something. I'll tell you who did that. I think Zero Dark Thirty. I mean, if you're going to talk about entertainment.
Yeah.
That film, of anything I've seen in a long time, really challenged me as a viewer. Because I didn't know half of what they were talking about, the language. I'm like, I just took it. Like, okay, wait, I'm in a CIA, secret room. I believe them, whatever they're saying. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to go with it. Like, I felt very, like I had to pay a lot of attention, not just sit back and kind of, I don't know, be lazy about it. So anyway,
that's good. That's the way it's supposed to be.
We veered off a lot from talking
about
authors.
Yeah. Tell me about your creative process when you're writing a book. How do you get your private time? Do you have to bribe your kids?
A lot of time, honestly, I really love to write. But it's a bit of a slugfest. I'm not going to lie. It's hard work. It's just sitting there and saying I'm not going to do other things that I would really love to do right now, like my laundry, for instance, or, polish the silver. I don't know. It just anything else looks tempting when faced with sitting down by yourself, and not communicating with anybody and not moving around and just kind of being still with yourself. And once you get that initial draft of what you're working on, it's never good the first time. I mean, it's so rare when I write something and I don't have to tweak and change and edit. And that's why I call it a slugfest. And because it's just hard work. There's many people out there who are so much more talented than I am. I mean, there's scads of authors just leave me amazed. But a lot of them they don't have the will to keep fighting it out. So maybe they'll come up with one or two things that they write and they're really, really pretty good. But they don't have the discipline to sit down there and say, okay, I'm not going to polish the silver today, or whatever it is they have that, you know, steals their time. They don't do that, and I meet a lot of people that want to be writers and they're aspiring to it, and that's the thing. You have to be able to kind of just slug away at it and fight it and punch it, and then you finally satisfy that there's something that you're not completely embarrassed to have somebody else look at.
Yeah, I understand.
So,
what do you think of the different styles of publishing that are happening right now with the self-publishing, the independent publisher, the smaller book houses? They're pretty much taking over for the larger publishers.
I think it's opportunity.
Me too.
I really do. I think it's tremendous opportunity for people that are hungry and they want to see something happen, and maybe they're doing something a little unusual and a publisher doesn't want to do it because it hasn't been proven before. They have the ability to get it out there, and then they have to promote it. And, you know, Sherry, that's hard for a lot of writers to do. Let's face it. We love writing because what? Maybe we're not the most social people in the world.
Maybe
you know,
you're very quiet or private or shy.
Very. And, you know, there's a lot of authors out there that don't want to be on television, and they don't want to speak to large audiences, and they don't want to. Cormac McCarthy is a perfect example. I mean, he's a stunningly good writer, and he has zero interest in self-promotion. I mean, when you read his stuff, it's like so brawny and tough, and like it's like a big muscle between the covers of the book. And this guy, you get the sense he doesn't care. Read him, don't read him, he doesn't care. He just is all about the work. Those people that, you know, are going the independent route, print on demand and things like that, they can't afford to be like Cormac McCarthy. They have to get out there. They have to speak. They have to make, you know, phone calls upon phone calls and say, hey, I'd like to talk to you about my book, or would you mind carrying my book? Or you know, they have to be salesmen.
Yep.
And it doesn't come naturally to a lot of us.
I know. And I mean, self-promotion is not the easiest thing. It's just not. It you don't want to really talk about you. We're basically, as Americans, I don't know about the rest of the world, but as Americans, we're trained that talking about yourself is selfish, self-involved, blah blah blah. And when you're having to promote yourself or something, you're like, you're fighting your training.
Yeah, well, isn't it kind of considered like poor manners, you know, to talk about yourself? And I forgot who said I is the most boring word in the English language, but, you know, I think of that all the time.
Me too.
Especially on the blog.
You have to. I mean, if you want to get it out there, get sales, promotion is the key. I mean, and it's actually, to me, harder work than writing.
Yes. I would agree with that. I would definitely agree with that. Because you're uncomfortable, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing to do. But then what I do, especially with Love Mom, I have to remind myself that a lot of people might not know about the book who really seriously need it.
Exactly.
And that gets me over the hump, you know, because it's very funny where that book has gone and who's read it, and it's not always the reader that you think you've written it for who picks it up and gets something out of it. Well, not to be so mysterious.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you, why don't you tell a little bit about your book and what you'd like people to get out of it?
Oh, sure. Well, Love Mom is a memoir about my experience having a stillborn baby. And this is something that took me a very long time to get into book form. What it started out being was after this had happened and I was just reeling. I mean, I just didn't know how to make sense of the world anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I kept writing every day in a journal, and it was just a way for me to stay sane
to deal with.
It was a way for me to try to make sense of something that made no sense. And I kept at that for a long time. And after a period of time, I thought, you know, not everybody is trained to write, you know, especially on a daily basis. And I'd been keeping journals for years and years. It helps kind of prime the pump, the writing pump, you know. And I thought, you know, if I could get this book out there, then maybe it will inspire one person to journal and help her feel better. And that was it. I felt if I could even help one person feel the least bit better after having lost a child, it was worth it.
Right.
And that is what drove this story forward. And so it's really my story. It's not a traditional self-help book. You know, it doesn't give you step-by-step guide, like here's what you do. But grief really isn't like that. You know, grief is not really a step-by-step thing, and it's a little unpredictable. It's very unpredictable, as a matter of fact.
And I think it's very individual, too, because everybody's different.
Everyone's different, and everyone's background's different, and everyone has different things that bring them solace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that was meant to just inspire somebody to say, okay, well, I'm not Cynthia, but Cynthia's in a better place now, so maybe I could try something that could make me feel a little bit better and I could have a little hope. Because at the time that I wrote it, there were not a lot of books on the subject that weren't written by doctors.
Right.
These were not firsthand accounts. These were just doctors documenting, you know, why it happens and the behavior of mothers after it happens, and it was very clinical. Or there were very religious books, people that were extremely religious, talking about, you know, God meant for this to happen and it was all part of his plan. And neither of these two sides or these two types of books, you know, the medical book or the religious book, they didn't work for me, Sherry. They didn't make me feel better. They didn't give me hope.
They don't test you.
I'm sure they help some.
I mean, you know. But you already have to be indoctrinated into that kind of world. Most people want to know how someone else is handling it. And I think that what you're doing is wonderful because it's touching the human side of it. That's what's missing when you're talking the big concepts, you know,
right,
is the
right.
human side of it.
So, you know, I think that, you know, I don't go out and read books on this subject anymore. This was, you know, something that took place over 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I have zero desire to read books on this subject, but I know that they're there because, you know, sometimes people will make comments on Amazon or Goodreads or whatever, and they'll refer to other books here and there. And, you know, and also on Amazon you can see, like, people who bought your book also bought, you know, multiple.
Yeah. I always
so
think that's amusing.
So I know there must be many more books on the subject now, and that makes me happy. That really does. It means that more people are being more open about a subject that's very dark and scary, and, like, you know, a lot of moms feel like they're the only moms in the world that this has happened to because people don't want to talk about stillbirth. And anything that brings it to light kind of demystifies it a little bit, makes you feel a little less lonely or weird for this having happened. So,
and you went on to have healthy children, so... You had a happy ending.
I had a happy ending, yes. I mean, the things that, you know, listen, nobody gets out of this life without taking their lumps on the head, you know.
Yeah. That's the way it is.
That's how it goes. If you think they do,
you're wrong.
Just
watch biography for a few weeks and watch all the different biographies, and you realize, oh, all the people I thought lived perfect lives don't.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's truly... Those scars we have, those experiences that we live through, they change people in a very profound way, and often make them better people, make them more empathetic, kinder, stronger, wiser. I mean, I know that, you know, I am not the same person I was before this happened. Not that I was a bad person, but, you know, I certainly didn't trust my own gut to the degree that I do now. And I think
it helped make you grow. That's always a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Although I wouldn't wish it this experience
on
my worst enemy.
Yeah.
But, anyway, it's a quick read. It's it's meant to be a quick read, and I put it out there at 99 cents on the Kindle because I never want someone not to be able to get it. You know what I mean? Because of money.
That's great. Are you working on anything now?
I am.
Tell us about your new one.
This one is kind of what we were talking about before about boys needing more books, things they can relate to. And I'm working on a young adult book. It's kind of similar to The Hardy Boys in that it's a group of kids.
I read that, and I'm a girl.
I read Hardy Boys, I don't even know how many Hardy Boys books I read as a kid. Maybe I was a tomboy and I just didn't know it. Maybe you were too.
Yeah. I liked any book. I mean, I read Tom Sawyer. I mean, and then I read Little Women and stuff like Heidi.
Yeah.
So I read everything.
Everything. Yeah. I went through the dog stories, the horse stories, yes. So this is what I'm working on, and it's really been a lot of fun because, Sherry, when you drive carpool or you have kids over the house for years on end, you hear how they speak and what they think, and for some reason I became invisible while I was driving them around a little league practice or school or whatever, and I really got a chance to hear in the car mostly what troubles them and what boys find funny and what frightens them a little bit. And, you know, these are the things that kind of went into making up this story. So it's very different from things that I've done before. And, of course, the agents hate that, right? Why are you doing that? You know, you don't, what do you know from young adult? What, you know, why aren't you doing blah, blah, blah? But I have to do what speaks to me. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah.
Got to have some fun.
You have to have your adventure.
Yes.
That's what I think of all of this. I think of my writing, my radio, when I do acting, anything. That's all part of the great adventure of learning new stuff. I mean, you have to break through and do stuff you've never done before. Or why are you here?
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's probably from a business perspective not the smartest move. But I really, I feel like, you know, life is going by very quickly. You know, every day is so full. And I don't want to waste my time working on something because, you know, it just made business sense.
Yep.
Not when it comes to creative stuff. Just can't go there.
You have to be true to yourself.
Definitely. So I hope I can come back on your show and talk about that when it comes out.
Oh, I'd love you to. I really would. We're coming to the end, and I want to thank you very much for a wonderful interview.
Sherry, thanks for having me. It was really fun talking to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Next week, my guest is going to be producer-actor Timothy Woodward Jr. He's a star of Hollywood East, and he has some new productions he's going to talk about. I'd like my live audience to thank Cynthia for a wonderful interview. And I want to thank you, too. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thanks, Sherry.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.